This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Afghan officials say government forces have repelled an attack by Taliban militants on a major border crossing with Pakistan. The UN announces the formation of a panel to investigate systemic racism in policing, with the U.S. being at the center of it. And also, South Korea tightens its restrictions, and Australia extends a lockdown in its largest city, Sydney, amid a surge in coronavirus cases. Welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, the Taliban say they've captured an important trade route linking Pakistan with southern Afghanistan. A Taliban spokesman says the border town of Wesh and a road linking the two countries' customs in Kandahar province is now under the control of the militants. This is while the Afghan government says its forces have repelled the Taliban attack on the transit point. Taliban militants have already captured three other crossings along Afghanistan's borders. They've increased their attacks on cities and villages since May, seizing dozens of rural districts. Our correspondent Amin Alami is joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin, what details do you have to share with us with regards to these supposed advances made by the Taliban?
Well, Badia, according to Taliban militant group, they have captured the key border area in southern Afghanistan and mainly in Kandahar province. Isbin Buldak is considered as a point that is a border area connecting southern Afghanistan to neighboring Pakistan. In the meantime, the Taliban also says that Wesh and Chaman are two other points that are under the heavy attacks of the militant group. But instead, the Afghan security forces in Kandahar province, as well as officials here in Kabul, reject such claim by the Taliban, saying that Afghan forces have pushed back a recent Taliban attack on Isbin Buldak, the border point or border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan in southern Kandahar province. But in the meantime, Afghan local sources in Kandahar also say that as a result of counterattack operation conducted by Afghan special forces, mainly Afghan border troops, over 50 Taliban militants have been killed, including foreign nationals. But in the meantime, the Taliban says that they are struggling to bring more areas under their own control. However, locals and villagers there say that fightings are underway in some parts of Ispin Buldak in southern Kandahar province of Afghanistan, and in some cases civilians have lost their lives as a result of fightings between Afghan troops and Taliban militants in this border point of Afghanistan in southern part of the country.
No, we're going to leave it there. Amin Alami, our correspondent, joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. An explosion targeting a bus in northern Pakistan has left at least 8 people dead. A Pakistani official said the bus was carrying over 30 Chinese engineers to the site of Dasu Dam in Upper Kuhistan. He said 6 Chinese were among the victims. Security officials are investigating whether the blast was the result of a roadside device or something planted inside the bus. A rescue operation was also launched to find 2 missing people as a result of the explosion. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. The Dasu Hydroelectric Project is part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor that is aimed at connecting western China to Gwadar Seaport in southern Pakistan. The United Nations is set to establish a panel of experts to investigate systemic racism in policing amid widespread discrimination against people of African descent, especially in the U.S. The panel of 3 experts in law enforcement and human rights will have a 3-year mandate to probe the root causes and effects of racism. It will look at issues ranging from excessive use of force, racial profiling, and police handling of peaceful protests. The panel will investigate law enforcement across the world, but the United States will be the focus of its work with the murder case of George Floyd in 2020 as its reference. For years, the U.S. has been the scene of police killings of African Americans. Official data show the United States has witnessed its largest hike in inflation in over a decade last month. According to a report by the U.S. Labor Department, the consumer price index jumped by 5.4% in the 12 months ending in June, hitting its highest rate since August 2008. With the COVID-19 restrictions eased, American consumers have resumed spending and traveling but are being faced with soaring prices. According to the report, the price of gasoline has surged by over 45% over the past year. This is while Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell says the factors driving up the prices will disappear in the coming months. He's set to appear in Congress on Wednesday for a 2-day questioning by lawmakers. The Syrian foreign minister slams the U.S. and the European Union for imposing sanctions and taking other coercive measures against his country in a virtual address to a session of the non-aligned movement. Faisal Mehrdad said the Western sanctions have had a catastrophic impact on the day-to-day life of Syrians. He noted that the restrictions have hampered the government's ability to meet the basic needs of the people of Syria. Mehrdad also stressed his country's determination to end all illegitimate foreign military presence. The top Syrian diplomat condemned the Israeli regime for its repeated attacks on the Arab country as well as its occupation of Syria's Golan Heights. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Damascus, who told us more about the suffering endured by the Syrian people due to years of Western sanctions.
Well, it's clear there is a lot of suffering over here. Syrians are suffering heavily. Prices of basic material, food and medicine is rising almost every week. The exchange rate of the Syrian pound against the dollar is also deteriorating because of such sanctions. And also, it's not just because of the sanctions. It's because of the U.S. occupation of northeastern Syria and of the natural resources of Syria. As you know, the United States is illegally inside Syria. It occupies most of the richest oil fields inside Syria. It allows the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces to make use of all of those natural resources. Thus, most of the Syrian people in most parts of the country cannot have any of those resources. And this is also a major factor that is causing such an economic crisis inside Syria.
New revelations have surfaced showing the lengths top officials in Saudi Arabia are willing to go to consolidate their power in their quest to suppress dissent. They don't discriminate between former government officials or human rights activists. This is while the international community turns a blind eye to their rights record, with countries like the U.S., the U.K., and France continuing their arms sales to the kingdom.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spymaster and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
When it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassin squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke. He's threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018.
Saudi Arabia has a long track record of crushing dissent and silencing the opposition, but the crackdown escalated after 2017 when Mohammed bin Salman was appointed as crown prince and turned into a de facto ruler. The assassination of Jamal Khashoggi made headlines, but the kingdom is committing other human rights violations, including torturing dissidents and activists. A new report has shed light on Riyadh's torture tactics against women's rights activists.
From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of blood behind, but that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest the people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
This treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of humanity against humanity. Whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense.
Elsewhere, South Korea has tightened its restrictive measures. As the country sets a new record for daily COVID-19 cases, the East Asian country reported 1,615 new coronavirus cases in the past 24 hours. It resulted in the imposition of new social distancing measures across the country, with the toughest ones in the greater Seoul area. The restrictions come amid growing concerns over vaccination stagnation and the spread of the more contagious Delta variant. Officials say the new strain accounts for more than 30% of the new coronavirus cases in the country. The total number of cases in South Korea now stands at over 171,000, with over 2,000 total fatalities. Australian authorities extend a coronavirus lockdown in the country's largest city, Sydney, after 3 weeks of restrictions fail to stamp out an outbreak there.
And it always hurts to say this, but we need to extend the lockdown at least a further 2 weeks, from Friday the 16th of July to Friday the 30th of July.
The restrictions were extended after the state of New South Wales identified 97 new locally transmitted cases. The daily caseload represents a slight increase from 89 infections reported a day earlier. Total infections now stand at just over 900 in Sydney, while two deaths have also been reported. The city of 5 million residents was first plunged into a lockdown in late June after a Delta variant outbreak. Since then, many non-essential businesses are closed and people can leave homes only for essential activities. The death toll from 5 days of violence in South Africa has risen to 72 as troops are dispatched to help overstretched police quell the unrest. The violence was set off by last week's imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma. It has now widened into looting and an outpouring of anger, general anger, over inequality in the country. Nearly 760 people have so far been arrested. On Monday, the Constitutional Court heard an application to review its decision to jail Zuma for contempt of court. The court has reversed, or rather has reserved, its judgment to a later but unspecified date. Zuma is sentenced to 15 months in jail for not appearing before a commission looking into graft scandals during his presidency. France has announced that its military presence in the Sahel region will end in the first quarter of 2022. President Emmanuel Macron said there will be a gradual reduction of military forces and the end of the Barkhane operation. However, he noted that France is not withdrawing entirely from the region. The Barkhane operation dates back to an initial deployment in January 2013 as Paris intervened to allegedly fight terrorism in Mali. France currently has more than 5,000 troops in the Sahel region, which stretches across Africa, south of the Sahara Desert, and spans half a dozen countries. During the past years, France has maintained military intervention in the volatile area under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but has failed in its purported mission. A new UN report says at least 1,146 migrants lost their lives while trying to reach Europe by sea in the first half of the year. The International Organization for Migration says the figure is 2 times more than the first half of 2020. Also, the number of refugees and migrants traveling on sea routes to Europe has increased by 56%. The IOM says the real number of migrant deaths is much higher, as many shipwrecks go unreported and others are hard to verify. Human rights organizations have warned that the lack of proactive search and rescue operations in international waters is a contributing factor to the increase. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
Palestinians have rarely been afforded a voice in Western and especially American news outlets, says Amal Haddad Ryder in an article published under the heading, Gaza is still under attack, but you wouldn't know it from Western media. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In mid-May, as the Israeli regime military pummeled the Gaza Strip with shattering force, a medical student in southern city of Rafah sent a plea to a friend, who shared it with another friend, who shared it with the nation. The student's name was Nur al-Shair, and she was desperate to speak up for our voices to be heard, for our story to be out, as she wrote. I have lived through three heinous wars only to live up to fourth. That already feels worse than all the previous three piled up together, she continued. Safety is not an option in the strip, and it hurts me so much reading the news on the Western media, seeing how the stories are all one-sided. For two brief years, al-Shair studied neuroscience at Washington and Lee University in Virginia, but she had to return home during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Zionist regime did not allow al-Shair to leave the strip to return to school. Palestinians must apply for a permit to leave Gaza and are rejected more often than not. So she enrolled in medical school in Gaza. During the 11 days of the Israeli regime's latest bombing of Gaza, the regime's airstrikes killed 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, while over 72,000 Gazans were made homeless. While the two sides agreed to a ceasefire, the violence faced by Palestinians has not ceased. In the West Bank, Al-Quds, occupied territories, or, of course, in Gaza. There, in the besieged strip, people are not only struggling with the aftermath of the onslaught, but also with ongoing bombing. As al-Shair said, the ceasefire doesn't mean that the Israeli regime stopped activities in Gaza. 2 days ago, they sent around 10 quadcopters aircraft to the strip. That's breaking the ceasefire, but who cares? Nobody cares, and nobody listens to us. And she noted, nobody, above all not the media, stays focused on Palestine when the bombs stop falling. When the media stops talking about Palestine, we think of it as the win for the Israeli regime. What a lot of people fail to understand is that the ceasefire does not mean life is perfect now. Before the attacks, it was already miserable. The blockade has been imposed on Gaza since 2007. The Israeli regime counts the calories that come into the strip and decides how much food Palestinians allow to eat. This is apartheid. It should not be acceptable. Palestinians have rarely been afforded a voice in Western and especially American news outlets. Al-Shair said, now the people know they actually need to force their governments to impose sanctions and withdraw all funding from the Israeli regime. That's tax money being used, and since it's a democracy, they should have a say in where their money goes. I think a lot of Americans are still missing BDS. BDS would make a lot of difference and actually impose sanctions on the Israeli regime and change the reality for the Palestinians. It would get us much closer to our freedom and getting our rights back and stopping the killing of Palestinians. I think some people are lost. What with all the allegations and attacks on BDS that call it anti-Semitic? But there is always going to be attacks against what we say in Palestine. It's time for them to actually believe us, she added. The resilience of people in Gaza is absolutely amazing, al-Shair said. After the ceasefire was declared, we'd lost so many lives. People lost their homes. I lost my pregnant cousin with her child. Her other son is alive. He lost his mom and sister, but he just made it. We lost people we care about, but as soon as the ceasefire was declared, we all came into the streets. We missed aid because aid was during the attacks. So we started doing takbir for aid, like Allahu Akbar. During the attacks, the night time was always the worst. There is always more bombing during the night. We got used to staying up late, and the night of the ceasefire, everybody left their houses wearing their aid clothes. The next day, I saw people all wearing aid outfits going to the sea and to parks. One moment, we were all at risk of being killed at any second. And now everybody is just moving on. It's just amazing. The second thing is that even though we were actively being attacked, people were okay with us being attacked if it meant we were standing in solidarity with the people in Al-Quds. Every time I think about it, I'm amazed. We knew that we would be killed at any second, but if it meant that we are at least taking some of the Israeli regime's power away from Al-Quds to be with us, we were fine with it.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
Lebanon's descent into what could end up being one of the top three worst crises in 150 years has been stunningly swift. The country's gross domestic product GDP, which measures the total output of goods and services, nosedived from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year, as per the latest Lebanon Economic Monitor released by the World Bank last week. The inaction by Lebanese authorities is not due to lack of knowledge or quality advice, but rather the failure to agree on effective policy initiatives and a political consensus that defends a bankrupt economic system, which, by the way, benefited a few for so long. The crisis has caused a grave social fallout that has pushed more than half of the population below the poverty line. The decimated purchasing power of the Lebanese pound has led to more than 40% of households reporting challenges in accessing food and other basic needs. Meanwhile, the nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the same year. Such dire socioeconomic conditions risk systematic national fallings with regional and potentially global consequences. Propelled by popular desperation and anger, impulsive protests now mark the advent of a longer period of unrest, chaos, and even a social explosion across the country as conditions continue to deteriorate. Lebanon is suffering from poor governance and a gaping lack of public accountability. To date, the country's three overlapping crises, a financial meltdown, the catastrophic Beirut port explosion, and the COVID-19 pandemic, have not been met with an effective government response. On the contrary, years of government corruption and incompetence laid the ground for Lebanon's accelerating collapse. Many observers have become habituated to Lebanon's dysfunction and perpetual sense of crisis, but Lebanon's current predicament marks a real departure from the past. Even in the worst days of the civil war, while lacking a government, Lebanese found informal ways to keep the country somewhat functioning. This time, it's a different Lebanon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. crisis hit Lebanon over the weekend teetered on the verge of complete chaos driven by the Lebanese pound's dramatic nosedive against the dollar that sent agitated Lebanese to the streets across the country, blocking highways with burning tires in Beirut and other areas, and attacking public utilities to protest the deteriorating economic conditions. Now, this coincided with the breakdown of public services that has left the country in total darkness, and with closed gas stations as a result of severe fuel, gasoline, and diesel shortages that have threatened to bring a complete halt to private generators on which the majority of the Lebanese public and businesses, including hospitals, depend for electricity. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, the collapsing Lebanese pound, which sank to a record low for the first time in Lebanon's history, trading at almost 18,000 Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar on the black market, coincided with the breakdown of the public services, as we just said, especially electricity, because there is no fuel to power the generators. No securing basic public services by any authority is like basically saying, we want chaos, go ahead and bring about the chaos to the country. Who benefits from all of this in Lebanon right now?
Hi to you, thank you for having me. As we know, everybody knows in Lebanon, and probably, most probably the Europeans, who really were the patronizing of the Lebanese political situation from the 90s with Rafiq Hariri, the martyr of Lebanon. And we know the situation in Lebanon is very miserable, it's going to abyss, and nobody would really have a kind of relief for what's going on. There are some thieves in Lebanon, especially in the political class, with their manager of this partnership between the capitalists, the bank owners, and some of the mafias of the sects in Lebanon, who are leading this country into this abyss. I'm not surprised of this collapse of the Lebanese pound. I'm really anxious about the future of Lebanon after this very critical situation. The situation is not only economic situation, it's a political situation. The Americans and the Europeans, especially the French, now talking about a new mandate for Lebanon because of the political change in the region. Now we have many choices probably. First of all, we have to get rid, to reconstruct Lebanon, to get rid of all these mafias and the bank owners and this system, this capitalist or this new liberal system. Would the Americans agree? Of course not. They are not eager to see solutions in Lebanon. They are not eager to see Lebanese are satisfied with their authorities. There are no actual authorities to authorize good things or to lead the state into a safe place. Actually, I'm really hesitant to say that all these people who are the solution in their hand are the thieves of the money of the country.
Dr. While billions. This brings us to that worse still. Lebanon was quickly sliding into a political abyss, into a risk of instability, into social unrest. The top leaders even failed to agree on forming a cabinet, a new government, to at least rescue what's left in the country's economy. Can you explain to us the dilemma that led to the state of political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, really, people, the Lebanese people, they have unveiled all these ambiguities in the Lebanese situation, and now they know that these people who are leading, or what so-called leaders in Lebanon, are not deserving this place or post or position because they have stolen all the money of the Lebanese. And that's why I guess the Lebanese have the right to raise their voice and go into demonstration or saying that we have no confidence, no trust whatsoever in this class. And the problem is that all these people were protected by the Americans and the French. And Most of them, they have connections with the American embassy and with the Saudis. Now the Saudis raise their hand and say, well, we don't want Hariri, because they said they really said we have paid a lot of money for some of them. Well, most of them, they counted from Jaja to Hariri and others. Well, not to say about other people, because these people are really leading the situation in Lebanon into this catastrophe. And they, of course, they can't make or shape or form any new government that would lead to a solution in Lebanon and relieve people.
Well,
because
they are the
problem.
Exactly. How could it be shaped otherwise in the media? How is it being shaped in the internal and also the foreign media? It's being shown that there is a dilemma, there is a problem, a bickering problem between the President Aoun and the Premier-designate Saad al-Hariri, who, by the way, has been designated since October 22, 2020. Now, there are trading accusations. Each one is just pointing to the other being of blame. And one wants to form a cabinet of non-partisan specialists to enact reforms and salvage the country from an all-out economic collapse, while the other seemingly wants to secure what is called in the media the Christian rights. What's the main reason for this statement? If Hariri actually has internal and external support, then what does President Aoun want?
Let's say it frankly, for once and for all. President Aoun came to the presidency in order to reform and make some ameliorations to the system, and he could not, because this mafia in these authorities, in the state, they have prevented and blocked any kind of reformation, because they have taken the money of the country. They have stolen the money of the country. How could they help General Aoun, President Aoun, in order to reform? That's the problem, I guess, because also with the political reasoning that would say General Aoun really stood by the resistance in Lebanon, and he did not do what the French and the Saudis want to do in Syria. All this, they are punishing these people, the environment, the environment of the resistance in Lebanon. And I guess this is a kind of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. What would they do in the future in order to solve the situation, because their men are really the problem? Would they agree, the French, and they are putting now some sanctions on their men? Would that solve the situation?
I really don't know. One more minute in this segment, Dr. Saleh, but the pound has lost more than 90% of its value, and the basic items have skyrocketed in prices. Do you think that we are looking at the biggest social and economic catastrophe, actually, in West Asia, or is there still time to salvage something?
Well, we are in turmoil. I guess the Americans want to see this kind of turmoil in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and other places, also in Yemen. They are really putting sanctions in order to these countries, to these states, to collapse.
Seems they
collapse.
Are succeeding, though.
They are. I guess the peoples of the West Asian countries, they can rebuild and reconstruct these countries, because they are the heritage of the Americans and the French. We have one choice only: to get rid of these peoples of between brackets, the Americans and the French and the Saudis, and mm-hmm. without kicking out these people from the decision maker of in Lebanon and in other places, in Iraq or in Yemen, the Hadi and his gangs. I guess without that, we can't rebuild mm-hmm. these countries and the region. And we are really, peoples are trying, resisting all this kind of hegemony from the 20th century till now. Peoples are going in the right track.
Hopefully so. Thank you very much from Beirut, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for being with us to talk about the economic and social collapse in Lebanon. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, the Yemeni armed forces announced earlier last week a military operation targeting Saudi forces, where days after the announcement, the Yemeni military media broadcasted scenes from the operation of the Yemeni armed forces targeting this camp of the Saudi coalition with dozens of Qassam 2K drones in the Al-Wadi'a border area. Now, spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Al-Sariya announced the killing of a number of Saudi officers and the killing of more than 60 fighters in the ranks of the Saudi coalition aggression. In this large-scale military operation, more in this following report.
Clashes intensified during the past week between the Yemeni armed forces and forces loyal to the outgoing President Abdullah Mansour Hadi within the Rahwan district, the second largest district of Ma'rib Governorate, which extends from northwest to west. This came in the wake of Hadi's forces violating a tribal truce signed in earlier March 2020 between Sana'a forces and some of the leaders of the Rahwan tribes, which stipulated the commitment of the army and popular committees not to attack the district's areas that had been neutralized from the ongoing confrontations. Under the agreement signed by the Marwan and the Shadawda tribes, the largest of the Rahwan tribes, which held for more than a year before Hadi forces violated it, Sana'a granted the people of the district the right to protect and manage their own security. However, the transformation of a number of areas of Rahwan district into a launching pad for the operations of Hadi forces and the Islah Party militias had little effect on the course of the confrontations on the western and southwestern fronts, where the skirmishes declined in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces were able to make new military progress west of the Khanjar camp, specifically in the Khub and Al-Shaga front of Al-Jawf Governorate. The military media center in Sana'a published audio and video documented scenes that showed the army and the popular committees in the area, in addition to showing scores of dead and injured Saudi mercenaries. In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sariya, confirmed that the drone air force was able to carry out a massive military operation targeting a training camp of the Saudi Emirati coalition in the Al-Wadi'a area, with 10 Qassam 2K drones targeting the command center, training sites, and sectors. Sariya pointed out that the operation, which was documented by video and audio, led to the killing of a Saudi officer and 60 members of Saudi mercenaries, including a number of military leaders. According to military sources in Sana'a, the targeted camp is under the supervision of the Central Military Command in the region and enjoys high protection and advanced technological security via American satellites. Sariya made it clear that targeting Al-Wadi'a camp was a message to Washington that will be followed by other messages during the upcoming period of fighting to liberate all of Ma'rib.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is author and academic Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Anderson. Now, footage of the Yemeni Armed Forces media showed Yemeni Qassam 2K arriving at the scene inside the Al-Wadi'a military camp, which is a very, very important camp on the border with Yemen, while Saudi soldiers and their mercenaries were fleeing. Whoever was left of them fled for their lives. Now, the Yemeni Armed Forces have been targeting Saudi military bases for a long time now. Why was this operation very significant for the Yemeni Armed Forces?
It's another step, really, in the Yemeni forces taking over parts of Najran, moving into area that has been disputed for a long time, but in any case, currently Saudi territory. So there's strong support they have also from some of the people there. So, and the use of the drones that you mentioned, as you said, has been used before against other Saudi military bases.
Well, during the same week, Yemeni army forces launched two missile strikes against the position of Saudi-led militants in Yemen's very strategic central province of Ma'rib, which is witnessing right now huge operations. They killed and wounded dozens of those mercenaries. Many reason might be behind the choice to take the time to liberate Ma'rib, because it's been over 5 months now that the operation of Ma'arabat started. However, if you want to break down the situation in this major city which is bordering Saudi Arabia, why do you think that the Yemeni armed forces led by the resistance forces of Ansarullah are taking their time to liberate Ma'arabat?
I don't think it's completely correct to say that they're taking their time. They've actually made a number of statements to say that we're going to, you know, move very quickly, and they wanted to move very quickly. But as you say, it's an extremely heavy battle, and it's the biggest stakes in the north of Yemen, really, because this is the one base that the Hadi so-called government based in Riyadh has. In other words, everything that the Saudis have been doing has been trying to reinforce this one significant base on the ground. And if and when Ansarullah-led forces take Ma'arib, that is going to change the complexion in the entire region, basically. And as you say, there's been heavy battle. There's been a lot of airstrikes on the forces coming in from the west, and the Yemeni revolutionary government is using ballistic missiles also against their targets there. I've read that there's been thousands of casualties there. So I don't think their aim is to slow it down. In fact, they are making some moves in other parts of the country at the same time, but this is a really the big battle in the north of Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, one very interesting thing happened last week was the breaking of an agreement that happened between the Yemeni armed forces and the biggest tribes of Ma'arib, because the mercenaries of Saudi Arabia broke that agreement and started shooting from those specific areas after long talks happened between Ansarullah and these tribes, and they all agreed that they should not fight. Do you think that Mohammed bin Salman is now trying to maneuver something new to maybe bring new enemies for Ansarullah to the table?
Well, there's always the aim to try and divide and carve out sections of the country. I mean, you know, that Hadi himself was the one who was trying to move back to a six-part partition of the country under Saudi direction. So they'll keep doing that. But I think there's a measure of desperation coming from Riyadh now, because they are losing on so many fronts. And the revolutionary government is making incursions into the south now at the same time. So they are fighting on more than one front.
Well, the Swedish foreign minister landed in Riyadh last week, where she met with Saudi foreign minister Faisal bin Farhan, and for God knows what reason, she met with Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, the ousted Yemeni president. Now, she tweeted that the discussions were concerning the peace efforts in Yemen for bilateral issues and for humanitarian issues as well, and humanitarian rights. Now, Saudi Arabia is still bombing Yemen. It's blockading the country, aerial, sea, land blockades, and it's sending even more mercenaries to occupy the country. What peace efforts is she talking about?
Well, the problem is that there is a very bad Security Council resolution, I think it's 2216 from 2015, which frames the whole conflict as though what they call the Houthis are the problem, basically, an outside problem, and somehow enshrines Hadi as legitimate president of Yemen. Now, Hadi had a interim role in 2012 through 2014, but somehow this Security Council resolution from 2015 has enshrined forever the role of this exile junta in Riyadh as the legitimate government. And so the language being used, and you see it in the Persian Gulf press and the Western press, the Yemeni government this, the Yemeni government that, they're talking about a regime, or not even a regime, but a group of people in Riyadh, basically, as the Yemeni government. So when other agents, including those, you know, looking at the UN security resolution, come in, there's a very difficult structure there to deal with. And you know, what Ansarullah, the revolutionary government, has said, that they'll agree to a ceasefire if the blockade is lifted, unfortunately, is undermined by this very bad Security Council resolution from 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Oman has been long perceived as a neutral party in the part of West Asia, and has spent the past few weeks attempting to get Saudi Arabia and Yemen to the negotiating table to find an end to the ongoing suffering of the Yemeni people. Now, the Yemeni conditions for any ceasefire, just like you just mentioned, are fixed. They are not negotiable. Ansarullah said it clearly by the movement's leader, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. He said, lift the siege,
halt all forms of aggression, just stop bombing the same place hundreds of times, and end the occupation. I think that these are reasonable. Even if I want to stand by the Yemenis, if I want to look, I want to take a different position and be objective about it, they seem very logical conditions there. What is the next move for Yemen in the event that Mohammed bin Salman just chooses to move forward with the aggression instead of accepting the reality and just giving up on his psychopathic warmongering policies?
It's very difficult. He's in a very difficult situation. Let's say the Saudi rulers are in a very difficult situation because they are losing on several fronts. They're having their own territory incursions into what they consider their own territory, as well as about to lose Marib, which is going to be a very big blow to them. And of course, the Emirates and Israel are in the south, you know, and there's some some movement going on there, let's say, in favor of the revolutionary government. So the Saudis have been suing for peace for some time because they know that they're losing, but they're hanging on to those shreds of so-called legitimacy that the UN gives them and that their Western backers are hanging on to, really. So, but nevertheless, the Saudis know that they're losing. They've gone to Iran, they've gone to Oman, they're doing talks, they're looking for peace. And in the meantime, as you say, the revolutionary government has put a very reasonable position. And while that's not met, they are simply going ahead with what they're going ahead with, and they're making more progress, basically. And this is, you know, the problem is the legitimacy battle going on internationally is going to try and sheet home responsibility to, you know, their favoured party. And so that's the dilemma in terms of the international debate.
Well, it seems that we are looking ahead to very decisive weeks ahead in liberating Ma'arib and see where things go for the action negotiations to move forward. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author and academic, for joining us from Sydney to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.
As governments in multiple EU states struggle to curb an increasingly alarming surge in COVID-19 cases, the Dutch Premier Mark Rutte has apologized and conceded that restrictions reinstated this weekend were lifted too soon. Meanwhile, the French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a raft of new measures on Monday, 12th of July, including making health certificates mandatory in cafes and restaurants and on planes and long-distance trains from next month. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley. The piece is titled, Dutch PM Sorry for Early Reopening as France Tightens COVID Rules. As governments in multiple European Union states struggle to curb an increasingly alarming surge in COVID-19 cases, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has apologized and conceded that restrictions reinstated this weekend were lifted too soon. Meanwhile, France's President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a raft of new measures on Monday, 12th of July, including making health certificates mandatory in cafes and restaurants, and on planes and long-distance trains from next month. While cases are rising, hospital admissions in most EU countries have not so far followed the same curve, prompting officials to suggest that, as vaccination campaigns advance, hospital data should become a bigger factor in responding to the pandemic. Dutch Premier Mark Rutte last week reimposed curbs on restaurants and nightclubs in the Netherlands, and cancelled all events involving large crowds until at least 14th of August, as new cases rose almost sevenfold, from a rolling seven-day average of 49 for every million people on 4th of July to nearly 330 at the weekend. What we thought would be possible turned out not to be in practice, he said on Monday. We had poor judgment, which we regret and which we apologize. At least 30 event organizers have launched joint legal proceedings over the U-turn. The Dutch Health Minister, Hugo de Jong, said last week that holidays could be affected by the surge, but he was hopeful that other European Union countries would look at hospital data rather than infections when debating quarantine or test requirements on Dutch travelers. 2 weeks ago, all the signals were green, Hugo de Jong said. Now there is reason to intervene. This is unprecedented. However, Dutch hospital admissions remain low at 2.7 million, down from a peak of more than 100 per million in early April. Meanwhile, France's President Emmanuel Macron said in a televised address on Monday, 12th of July, that French health workers who had not been vaccinated by September would face sanctions.